this is Ann Fagan, who, with Harold Kimball, are interviewing Dr. Frederick Forscher on November the 2nd, 1988, tape 3, side 1. Dr. Forscher, when last we talked, you were about to tell us about your work in NUMMEC. Would you pick up with that, please? You told us that it was in Apollo, Pennsylvania.
That's right. We started a company in 1957 because two friends of mine, that's Sal Shapiro from Pittsburgh and Len Pepkowitz, who lived in Schenectady, decided it was time to for private industry to enter the nuclear area. It was a few years after President Eisenhower signed the Atom for Peace bill, which allowed private industry to enter this field. And there were very few knowledgeable people who were willing to enter such a thing. So we did. And the company started with three people, the name I mentioned before, and a secretary who worked for Sal Shapiro in Venice. And then we go from a 10, 15 people company to a 50 people company. We hired the personnel man and the public relations person and the advertising problems and accountants and it go to about 150 and 200. Eventually, I was in the company for 10 years since the beginning, vice president of operation. We had about 600 people.
Okay, the company was called NUMMEC.
Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, and it's known as NUMMEC,
N-U-M-M-E-C.
Acronym. Yeah.
What did you do in lay people's terms? What kind of
things? We started with basically with the fuel, the nuclear fuel, which would be used by the then just starting up a nuclear power industry. Uh-huh. Of course, the Navy, nuclear Navy, started earlier and used in their nuclear power reactors on board the submarines and the ships later on, they used alloys, uranium alloys, which we, which everybody in the field recognized is, has a very limited temperature range, and for higher efficiency for these big power stationary power plants, which don't have to be so compressed like the submarine equipment. We could work with oxides, which have a higher temperature range. And so we developed oxides, primarily the production of uranium oxides, and became the largest source of these fuels for the nuclear industry, both domestic and foreign, in the beginning. That was just the start of the nuclear industry. Got to remember that the first nuclear power plant, which went on a electric utility network, was the shipping port,
yes,
which went on in 1957, just about a few months after we started.
Were you involved in working for the shipping port?
Yes, we did not work on the original core, mm-hmm, which was a Navy core and metal alloy other than oxide. But later on in the years, I forgot what year it was, it must have been in the middle 60s, when Admiral Rickhofer decided to prove that the standard light water reactors, of which Shippingport was a typical example, can be converted to breeders without too much problem. We got the job to provide the breeding fuel, which was a large number job. But we did many, many too long to really enter into a...
What do you think were the principal accomplishments, those things that you were proudest of during the time that you were there?
Well, there are several. First, from an economic point of view and from the national energy point of view, we first introduced the uranium oxide as a nuclear fuel for power plants and brought the price down from about $60 a kilogram to $6 a kilogram, which was a tremendous achievement in terms of facility design and operation. We developed a concept of concentrated energy, nuclear energy, which was sponsored by the Atomic Energy Commission. And I mentioned before that I went to Vienna in 1962 to present it to the International Atomic Energy Agency. That's the concept of coated particles. We also developed the applications of nuclear power for hard bases and space thermoelectric powers. We have a patent, for instance, on the electric, on a hard pacer, which is fueled by plutonium-238. Plutonium-238 is an isotope of plutonium which is has the characteristic that it is the largest energy source per gram of mass. In other words, you need very little material to get a lot of energy out of it. And we encapsulated this into a little triple encapsulation device without any moving parts, and the whole device became half the size of a cigarette pack. We checked it out with first in the laboratory, then with dogs, and with we got all kinds of
data.
We also did food irradiation work. We realized that radiation could sterilize, not only sterilize medical instruments, which they're using, of course, is up to the state, but also could be used to maintain viability of food, the viability, but good value before food deteriorates in air. And there we did a very large experiment done for Filsbury on Idaho, on Filsbury potatoes in Idaho. We irradiated hundreds of tons of potatoes and checked out that they don't change in taste, but will prevent the sprouting. Another application of this is, of course, the shipboard problems of the fishing fleet. When the fishing fleet goes out in the ocean to fish, they put the fish in the aboard and can't come back right to the... So they have to, up to now, they have to have fantastic large refrigerators to keep this fish fresh before they come back to the harbor. We suggested that, and the Bureau of Fisheries accepted our proposal to install a nuclear radiator on board the ship and prevent the fisheries from spoiling.
Is that an accepted procedure now?
I don't know. The other application, of course, is for citrus foods. Israel, for instance, couldn't compete with citrus foods from southern Europe, from Italy and Spain, when their citrus season is in full force. And in order to prolong the citrus life of the Israeli food, we built actually formed a little company in Israel to irradiate oranges and other citrus foods which come from Israel.
Is that
and that was later on superseded by another device, which is mostly nitrogen. They found out when they shipped citrus fruits in nitrogen-sealed containers, large containers, that it will apparently preserve it just as well. And,
is it that less expensive than doing it?
It apparently, I'm not quite sure about the economics. The economics always changed. And we also did built a nuclear radiator, food radiator in Hawaii, because the papaya and mangoes food was not allowed to be imported to the 48 states. And the Hawaiian government wanted to have some assurance that the weasel infestation would be overcome, and that's what this radiation does. We had quite a bit of experience in the food radiation field, but we had many, many other things to point to, and it's too long to go into this type of discussion. I'd like to say, however, that later on, after I have already left NUMEC, the Smithsonian started the collection of the history of American technology. And my scrapbook and my 10 years of work in, not mine, but the company's 10 years of work in this field was so fundamental that they incorporated in the history of American technology.
Oh, it's not Smithsonian. That's lovely.
The whole history of our development, the growth of the company, what we did a lot of export work. We got many big E for export flags from the Commerce Department. We did some fundamental work in accountability and measurement of nuclear materials. It was a very challenging period, and we had very, very good people to work with.
You chose to sell it to a larger company, and then you in turn went back to Westinghouse for a while, you said?
Yeah, it wasn't my choice. It was the board of directors agreed to sell it. And because the large ARCO at that time, Atlantic Richfield, it's now known as ARCO, oil company, was interested in the energy, to spread out into the energy area. And nuclear power was a growing and coming industry. And here was they are particularly interested in fuels. They are in coal and oil and have gas interest. And so that a fuel company, which we were the first one, and not the only one at that time anymore, but the first and best known fuel company, privately owned fuel company in the world, they wanted to tie in with us and take advantage of our experience and knowledge. So we did, and they took over many of these subdivisions, which I briefly mentioned, the fuel and the hot paste stuff. We had a plutonium division, which developed brand new processes of plutonium and mixed oxides. And it became well known internationally, so that the Japanese, who just got started in this field, asked us to design their first plutonium facility. And we became architect engineers to design the Japanese first plutonium facility. And there was another one of our achievements. We had experience in handling very dangerous chemicals, both toxic as well as explosive and radioactive. And the government needed somebody to run a company which was previously Hooker Company up in Niagara Falls.
Yes, Buffalo.
Yeah, yes. Near Buffalo, Newton. Yeah, and the Love Canal is, of course, the residue of that. We took over a division of Hooker because they wouldn't do a good job right, and ran a government facility which separates the boron 10 from boron 11. These are two isotopes of boron, which are very important to the control of nuclear power plants. We also developed a process by which we can purify hafnium, which is another control material. And in one time, we had about 80% of the world supply of hafnium in our shop. Hafnium is a very rare metal, which comes as an impurity in zirconium. And it needs a highly sophisticated separation process and then a further purification process to get this hafnium to work. The naval reactors are controlled by hafnium rods. As I said, we did so many different things that it doesn't pay to mention all.
Have you been disappointed since in the direction of a nuclear energy in this country?
Oh, very much so, but I have hopes that in the middle 90s we will be back into nuclear power. It's no doubt in my mind that sooner or later the public will recognize, just like in France or in Japan or in other countries, they have already recognized that nuclear power is the probably the safest and certainly the cleanest form of generating electricity.
And the problem of wastes and what to do with them, you think that will be solved as well?
That is already solved. It's just the public doesn't know about it. I can bring you up to date on this a little later in my discussion, because I've been doing this ever since I left Newmark and then worked for Westinghouse as it started in 67 as manager of advanced fuel. Westinghouse at that time decided to go into the fuel business also.
Was this at Bettis?
No, it was. It was. In the nuclear power division, at that time they had it all located in Forest Hills.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, they moved up to Monroeville, of course, and they started the nuclear center. But the division I was in, they grew so rapidly at that time, they had to rent two office buildings in Penn Center, with Sears's, you know.
Yes.
And I wasn't. I had my offices and half of my people there, and another part was in Cheswick. Where they had production facilities for components of nuclear power plants, and they decided to build their nuclear fuel division, and which fuel elements are just another component of a nuclear power plant. They planned to build it there, and they also decided to build a plutonium development laboratory there, and didn't have anybody who really was experienced in it, so it came under my supervision. I finished the laboratory, licensed it, and staffed it, and trained the people, and we built and we made some very interesting full-scale mixed oxide elements, and we sent them out to San Onofre in California for irradiation and testing, and it all worked well, except that the government decided they're not going to go into reprocessing, and therefore there won't be any plutonium. Unless you reprocess fuel coming out of nuclear power plants, there's no plutonium to put into plutonium cycles. So since they don't allow reprocessing, there was no plutonium economy. So we were no breeders. And so we Westinghouse eventually decommissioned it long after it was gone. And it turns out that when I built it for $3 million, the decommissioning cost about $7 million.
One of life's ironies.
Yeah.
You were at Westinghouse in this capacity for?
I was there from 67 to 71.
Uh-huh.
And the way I put it in my resume here, one-page resume, which I'll give you too.
Uh-huh.
As manager of advanced fuel, was responsible for activities, programs, and facilities, including their safety, reliability, and quality of products. Developed advanced chemical, ceramic, and metallurgical processes, and their evaluation in the pilot plant and semi-works, and completed the most up-to-date plutonium laboratory, obtained AC license, operated, staffed, and trained personnel.
Since that time, have you been an independent consultant? Or
yeah, since 71, I'm an independent consultant.
I see.
And that is actually the most interesting part of my career.
Why don't you tell us about that?
middle 70s, the public and got very concerned about proliferation of nuclear materials. It's the the bomb in the basement syndrome. And it turned out that because NUMEC was one of the first to handle this type of material, plutonium and highly enriched uranium, everybody was bouncing on us at NUMEC, where is this material which you processed? Well, NUMEC did also reprocessing, which I didn't mention in my discussion, reprocessing of scrap which came from plants which had the responsibility to make the fuel for the nuclear navy. And when they shipped us the material in drums, 55-gallon drums, they say there is, let's say, a kilogram of plutonium in there. But nobody could tell because you certainly can't handle it and you can't measure it. And it was only their paper calculation that it is there. It's not actually measured. But we were charged with that on paper again. Mm-hmm. And by the time we reprocessed it and found there's only, let's say, half of it in there, 500 grams, then after several years, the government said, well, where is this material? You must have shipped it on the story about NUMEC building the atomic bomb in Israel. It's well known. Mm-hmm. It's now a myth which will be living there. So in the middle 70s, the FBI came around. I was already a consultant to the National Bureau of Standards on measurement, of nuclear materials measurement, and I got a call from congressional committees, who I know many staff members, and I'll tell you why and how later. And the guy told me, well, have you been interviewed by the FBI? And I said, no, I've not been interviewed by the FBI. And they had already all these great activities about NUMEC and its diversion. So I said, well, we're going to change this. Well, sure enough, a week later, I got a call from the local FBI office. They want to interview me. And I was glad to be interviewed. And I took a tape so that I knew I taped my interview, and they taped it also. And of course, there was nothing to tell him about the diversion because there was none. But they asked me how come I got into NUMEC and why. And I want to mention this because it's maybe interesting a story for my grandchildren. As you saw in the last time, I have some talent in art and inherited from my father. And so my early career was really connected with art, and I worked in theater design and stage issues and lighting, phenomena, architecture, of course. But since I came to the States and ended up in the army, in the military, in the engineering capacity, and went back to Princeton to become an engineer and then a scientist, I felt it very satisfying, just like a satisfaction in artwork. It's a creative aspect. It's the breaking new ground in the scientific area, in the materials area. So when I, after 5 years with Bettis, and I did a lot of, I mentioned, I wrote a lot of fundamental papers, and they were well received by the scientific and engineering community. And Zal Shapiro thought maybe we should start a business. I figured, well, I tried art, I tried science. Maybe I should see whether business is not as challenging an occupation. Mm-hmm. And this is really the basic reason why I started a company with Zal. It is a very satisfying. It's very hard work. It's from 7 in the morning till often 11 at night, all weekends and so forth. But it's very satisfying to see it grow, to see the employment of people and the production which results. I told this to the FBI. That's why I mentioned it here. A couple of weeks later, a month later, I got another call from a friend in the Congressional Committee, and they said, well, have you been interviewed by the FBI? I said, sure have been. No, who was there? And he knew that the FBI had about seven people from the headquarters in Washington on this particular issue. Well, I named the people, the two people there, both from Pittsburgh office, and the guy almost fainted on the phone. He said, this, they think this is an important issue, and this, the only guy who can really give him some quantitative information, could, and they sent the guy from Pittsburgh who's just not informed at all about this. And so it was just ridiculous. Well, I didn't hear from him anymore. But I was very fortunate because of the history which I explained to you to be well known in the community and in the scientific engineering community, metallurgical materials area. And so I had many offers, for instance, the insurance industry, the nuclear insurance industry, needed some guidance of standardizing the fire protection in nuclear facilities. It is well known by the time the public had understood that that water moderates the neutron, and so if you have a fire in a nuclear plant where you have a lot of these random plutonium materials around, you couldn't use water because you would create, by stopping the fire, would create a chain reaction. So there are rules which I am very familiar with of how to prevent chain reactions. And they asked me to chair a committee for fire protection in these facilities, which I did for them. The result of this for many years effort was several good standards, fire protection standards, which are still being used by the NFP, National Fire Protection Association, and the insurance industry, and so forth. Congressman Moorhead, who was a congressman at that time from Pittsburgh, was interested in energy and scientific areas. And his neighbor was in the office building, the Brayburn building in Washington, was Chet Hollowfield, congressman from California, who was the chairman of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. The Joint Committee on Atomic Energy was established during the Manhattan Project years and was the only committee in Congress who has had jurisdiction over the Atomic Energy Commission, all the nuclear power facilities and licensing activities, transportation, and production of nuclear materials like Oak Ridge, argon, Paducah, and so forth. Now, Moorhead was on the not on the Joint Committee. He was on the Government Operations Committee. And there was a strong push, it was in the 70s, when the environmental movement became strong, grew up, and the anti-nuclear lobby focused on slowing down or actually stopping and dismantling the nuclear power plants. The first target these lobbies had was to break up the Atomic Energy Commission. The argument was there's an organization which is both promoting nuclear power and regulating it, and you cannot do this together. You can't be the judge and the jury at the same time. And Chet Hollowfield, who was ready to retire, felt it was a strong argument and a good place for him to close the books and both break up the Atomic Energy Commission into two parts, which we did, into ERDA and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Same time, give up the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. And that was the tragedy. Breaking up the Atomic Energy Commission was not that bad, but disbanding the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy was a tragedy, because there are now seven committees, and it's an impossible way to get anything accomplished in the halls of Congress.
What would you see as a better arrangement, some overall chairperson?
Well, it should be a joint committee, like the joint committee was. It was a very unusual joint committee established during the war, and had legislative as well as appropriation powers. See, there are other joint committees, like the Joint Committee on Economics. Moorhead was a member. But they have only debating points. They are not a really legislative committee.
Mm-hmm.
Joint committees are committees of both the Senate and the House.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, Moorhead asked me to be his advisor in science and engineering matters. And I was 3.5 years on his staff, full-time.